From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Most Americans understand that the U.S. economy is, to paraphrase Bernie Sanders, rigged against the majority of us. In fact, the health of our economy is generally measured by the well-being of the stock market and corporate profits. When economic recessions hit, the rich are bailed out and move on with almost no consequences. Under President Donald Trump, wealthy Americans have prospered even more, winning massive tax cuts while the rest of us continue to struggle. Yet we are told that the economy is humming along smoothly. How do we make the economy work for all of us? My guest says in a new book, we have to democratize it. Ted Howard is co-founder and president of the Democracy Collaborative, formerly the executive director of the National Center for Economic Alternatives, and he's the co-author with Marjorie Kelly of the new book, The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. Welcome, Ted.
Wonderful to be with you, Sonali.
So as I mentioned, people really do feel that the economy is rigged against us. If you're not in the 1% or even in the top 10%, you're struggling. Most Americans, even if they seem like they're well set, are often living hand to mouth. We don't have too many savings. And we're told that this is how it's supposed to be. Do you think that it's very clear that their statistics are discussed enough and people know enough from their own experiences that they understand this is not an this is not right. This is not an economy that is working?
Well, I think it's irrefutable that the vast majority of Americans think that the economy is somehow rigged against them. Unfortunately, what we're seeing playing out in a lot of our politics these days is people are misidentifying what the source of their pain is and why they're falling behind economically, and why our middle class is being hollowed out, why generations of people are trapped in poverty. And of course, we're seeing it play out politically on our televisions right now, where people are being scapegoated as the source of the problem, whether they're immigrants, people from Mexico, others. But the actuality is that what we have is a situation where less than 1% of our population is sucking up the vast amount of the growth of the economy, while literally tens and tens and tens of millions of people, including working people and middle-class people, people with three jobs, are falling behind. And literally, there's one amazing statistic. 47% of Americans cannot assemble $400 in the face of an emergency, like their car breaking down, something going wrong with their house, or a child having a broken ankle. So the inequality is absolutely clear. The question is the battle over what is the source of our economic woe.
What are some of the examples that you can give our audience about how the economy is rigged? I mean, I mentioned the tax cuts under President Trump. That's a very clear way in which those getting the tax breaks are the ones who need it the least. Are there other examples where the richer you are, the more likely you are to get even richer?
Well, you know, we could spend the next week going through the data because it's just absolutely stunning. But here are a couple of facts. Since the Great Recession of 10 years ago, the financial crisis, there has been a boom in the stock market. Of course, our president says it's the greatest economy ever. The stocks are up. All that's true. And yet, 95% of all the gains in the economy in terms of income and wealth in the last 10 years have gone to 1% of the people. Another really stunning statistic for me is just three people, and your listeners will be familiar with their names, Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, and Bill Gates, own as much wealth as the bottom 160 million of us. That's virtually half the country. So the concentration of wealth, particularly since 1980, when the kind of neoliberal agenda, it's called, that was ushered in by Margaret Thatcher in the United Kingdom and Ronald Reagan in this country, this escalating inequality has become just completely off the charts. I have a colleague who's my co-founder, a very eminent political economist, historian named Gar Alperovitz, probably many of your listeners will
yes,
know
his
work.
Yes, he's been on our program.
Yeah, so Gar tells a story that's fascinating. A few years ago, he was lecturing, a very big lecture, and talking about wealth inequality in the economy. And he characterized our current American economy in the 2000s as virtually medieval or feudalistic in terms of the concentration of wealth. At the end of Gar's speech, an older gentleman from Great Britain stood up in his British accent, which I will not try to replicate, said, Professor Alperovitz, I have to take issue with one thing you said. You said that our economy was almost feudalistic in its concentration. I'm a professor of 14th century England, and I can tell you that the economy in the 14th century was never as concentrated in fewer hands than it is today. So indeed, we do live in a medieval economy in the 21st century. And the book that I've written with Marjorie Kelly is an exploration of how do we move beyond this extractive economy that's just every day concentrating more and more wealth and sucking it out of our communities and bring the principles of democracy into our economy.
So if we see the handful of wealthy Americans owning and sucking up so much wealth, isn't an obvious solution moving to an economy where we simply tax the hell out of them? I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has suggested a 70% tax rate. That's, some argue, not even high enough. Tax the hell out of them and spread the wealth to the rest of us. That would be the sort of direct solution.
Well, I'm all in favor of much higher taxes on the 1% and the wealthy and the corporations in this country. But we need to take recognition of the fact that this system, this kind of what some have called casino capitalism, this financialized hyper-capitalism that we live under, it has been able to resist those kinds of changes repeatedly. You know, when we break up the big corporations that are monopolies, I'm all for that. But what happens is they regroup again because of the drive and the logic of the system. When we move to raise taxes higher and higher, there are always all of these outs and loopholes so that the wealth just keeps getting accumulated again and again. So I'm all in favor of higher taxes, policy changes, getting better people in office. But we have something that goes, I believe, and we argue in the book, an economic problem that goes beyond policy and politics and is in fact systemic and is inherent to the design of the kind of capitalism we have today. And in my view, and again, we argue in our book, that if we don't address the very heart of the system and how it's designed, we will continue to have these consequences, whether it's an inability of our system to take meaningful action on climate change or the escalating wealth inequality. And let me say, this wealth inequality issue is so important, not only because wealth begets more wealth, but, you know, it's going off the charts under President Trump. But let me tell you, under President Obama, who had a very different philosophy and a different politics, wealth inequality was escalating then too. Not as fast, but it continues under Democrats and Republicans for the last 100 years. And that's because the system is constructed in a way that it breeds inequality.
So let's talk about the solutions you discuss in your book, which is the reason why you're here and why you wrote the book, The Making of a Democratic Economy. The city of Cleveland points the way to means of our model, if you will, of how from the ground up people can begin democratizing the economy. Tell us about the Cleveland model.
Well, and I talk to you from Cleveland. I actually live in Cleveland, Ohio these days, so I'm in my apartment, right downtown Cleveland. Before I tell this story, let me say this book is about the economy, but I don't want to leave people with the impression that this is a turgid academic exercise. We have all the fact checks and footnotes, but this is really an attempt to change a narrative around the economy and inspire hope and therefore action. And Cleveland is one of the stories we tell. In Cleveland, Ohio, in the 1950s and 60s, this city was one of the five wealthiest cities in America. John D. Rockefeller was born here. Indeed, he's buried here. At one point, there were more Fortune 500 corporations headquartered in Cleveland than in any city in America except New York City. And there were 1 million population. Fast forward to where we are today, Cleveland is one of the 3 poorest cities in America. The population has declined because of deindustrialization and job loss from almost 1 million to 385,000. There are 2 Fortune 500 corporations left, and 35% of the entire city lives below the poverty line, and it's probably higher than that. So what we've seen is what happens when wealth is extracted out of an economy and out of this community. And so working with the city of Cleveland, the community foundation here, and our major hospitals and universities, what are called anchor institutions, as well as community residents, we created a strategy in Cleveland called the Evergreen Cooperatives, where we've built a network of for-profit businesses, but all worker-owned, green businesses located in neighborhoods where people are desperate for good employment. Most of the people we've hired, and we have several hundred and on the way to many more than that, have full-time employment now. We're almost all formerly unemployed. About half of them were ex-offenders, returning citizens, who it's very difficult for them to get jobs. And these companies provide goods and services to our large place-based institutions, which are the economic engine of the city. They're nonprofit institutions with some sort of social mission. We are growing 3 million heads of lettuce in downtown Cleveland, 300,000 pounds of basil in year-round hydroponic greenhouse. We have a renewable energy and green construction company. Another company is called Evergreen Cooperative Laundry that is washing now about 30 million pounds of towels and sheets and bed linens and doctor smocks for the hospitals. All of this providing family-supporting living wage, health benefits, and profit sharing for the workers. So what we're trying to do is rebuild the very basis of economic activity in our most disinvested neighborhoods, and doing it with new design principles. Everybody working in a company, not reporting to the owners who are absent and reporting to the man, if you were, but being owners of the company themselves, not outside investors, sharing in the profits, green companies. So that's just one of the models and one of the stories we tell.
So a co-op, but a for-profit co-op where the workers are participating in the profit making, where they reap the profits directly.
That's right. And participating in the democratic process of the company. This book is about bringing the principles of democracy that were infused, even if imperfectly, into our governing structures after the Revolutionary War, when the country began. What we're arguing for is let's extend principles of democracy to the economy and to the workplace. So in the Evergreen Cooperatives, the workers not only own a share of the company and share in the profits, but they help to elect the board of directors. The laundry, for instance, has a majority of the board are frontline workers in the company itself. The workers are determining how to use the profits of the company, how much should go into their pocket, how much should be reinvested in the company, and very importantly, they agree to stream 10% of their profits of their company to a cooperative development fund so new businesses can be started so that others in the community can have the same opportunity they have. And so these are very different. It's a very different design than a traditional American corporation. And by the way, the companies are quite profitable now.
So, why, you know, just to play devil's advocate, some would say, well, we've had co-ops for a long time. There are examples plenty around the country where you have such businesses coexisting within this economy that is hardly, way to transform the entire economy. How do you translate that to a bigger scale?
Well, you're quite right. I mean, you know, when we're talking with the Evergreen Cooperatives after a number of years, 250, 300 employees, in a few more years, we hope to have 1,000. But this is in a city of 385,000, as I've said. What these examples in our Making of a Democratic Economy book point to first are new ways to design productive activity and infuse these principles into your economy. And hopefully there's stories of inspiration that show in these difficult times what's possible. It is possible that workers can run the places they work in. But what we're talking about is the fundamental transformation of our capitalist political economy to a very new type of political economy. And so while the grassroots effort is good, there's going to need to be the kind of big order changes that some of our political leaders are starting to talk about. Like the Green New Deal could be done one way is do it and let Bechtel and Halliburton and all the big corporations that always get the large federal contracts, let them run the Green New Deal. Or another way is use the Green New Deal to begin to build up and bring to scale employee-owned businesses, social enterprise, public banks, and so forth all over the country. At the end of the day, if we're going to bring about the kind of change that I believe is needed, and we argue in the book, the transformation of our economy needs to become a political movement. We need millions of Americans who are going to stand up and say, we no longer want our tax dollars to be used for subsidies in this casino capital situation. So we're going to need to have, as we've had historically in America, social movements. There's going to need to be a movement to build a next system beyond capitalism as we know it.
So, Ted, earlier you were saying that most Americans understand the economy isn't working for them, but many lay the blame in the wrong place. And under the Trump administration, those who support him have seen his attempts to make the economy work for them as the right ones. And that involves a trade war or, you know, using Twitter to threaten corporations to not move jobs overseas. His supporters point out, well, there are now more jobs in states like Ohio, and it's thanks to Trump. What do you make of that?
You're quite right. And it's, you know, one of the great ironies of our time that, here in Ohio, which voted for Trump, it had voted twice for Obama, by the way. The very people that have voted for Trump are, sort of bedazzled by his act and some of the things he's doing, but actually are still falling behind even more so. There's a long history in America of people voting in a way that's not really in aligned with what their economic interests are. And I think it's up to us to bring that message to people all over the country. I mean, here in Cleveland, the people that are benefiting from the Evergreen Cooperatives, our workforce is probably 90% African American. But we need to find a way to start to build those kind of models in Trump country in rural Ohio so that people can see that there is an alternative to the kind of bluster and tax breaks for his friends that the president's giving. You know, at the end of the day, the kind of biggest challenge I think all of us face is not so much the power of the big corporations, although that's a big challenge, but our own sort of feeling that almost being terrified by the scope of the problem we're facing, feeling despair that anything can be done. And I think it's some of those emotions that the people who are supporting the president, at least they feel he's doing something, even if they don't understand it. So our job is to build and project a practical and shared vision of the possibility of a next system.
Right.
And work with people to help them understand it is possible.
Right. So Trump seems to be doing at least something. And unfortunately, the establishment Democratic Party, which is his opposition, and it looks very possible that Joe Biden will be the rival, doesn't really have a solution, or their solution is whatever happened before Trump is what we're going to return to, which is, of course, a losing proposition and certainly a way to lose an election. But you had people like Bernie Sanders who made inroads in, and some would argue within, Trump country by making clear that the economy isn't working for us. Unfortunately, of course, what we're going to hear a lot of in this election is those on the left want socialism, and in this election is a fight about socialism versus freedom. They don't say socialism versus capitalism, because capitalism is considered equivalent to freedom. And I'm wondering if you're going to find that things like the, you know, the Cleveland model, which we were discussing, this model of co-ops, is just dismissed as socialism, and therefore completely, you know, ignored or maligned, well, even worse.
Well, to this point, what we've done actually in talking about a more democratic economy and emphasizing not an ideology or an ism, but almost common sense propositions, there's a great deal of literature, for instance, that demonstrates without question that employee-owned firms are more productive, that in times of economic crisis, they shed workers at a far lower rate, workers earn better wages, their retirement accounts are grow by an order of two or three times the magnitude of a traditional 401k kind of arrangement. And we need to demonstrate what's possible. Sure, I mean, if Trump came to Cleveland and looked at what we're doing, he would call it socialism. I think we need to get into the battle of the ideas. I mean, in many ways, I'm very, very sympathetic to socialism. I'm not to state socialism like the old Soviet Union bureaucratized undemocratic kind, but in a sense, socialism is about broader ownership, socializing the ownership of assets, so that, for instance, Cleveland has its own, the city government owns the Public Power Authority. It's called Cleveland Public Power. In North Dakota, which is a very conservative state, the state has a state bank that's controlled by the state government where it puts all of its deposits. That is, in a sense, a socialized institution. It's public ownership, and it's in one of the most conservative states in the country. So, you know, I think I'm quite willing to go toe-to-toe with conservatives and their economists about these propositions, because I think the data and the future is on our side.
Well, finally, Ted, where is the sort of model that we've been discussing happening elsewhere in the country? You're in Ohio. We talked about Cleveland. Is this a model that you see multiplying elsewhere? Is the movement for worker-owned for-profit co-ops spreading? And is it trending upward?
Well, absolutely it is. And let me say the Cleveland story, which emphasizes the worker cooperative, that's simply one form of dozens of forms of how you build a more democratic economy. So, you know, for instance, I've done work on the Pine Ridge Reservation of South Dakota. This is where the Oglala Sioux, you know, were placed after the Indian Wars. On Pine Ridge, the unemployment rate is about 90%. There is literally nothing for people to do. And so we've worked with a number of really courageous and dynamic young Sioux leaders and as they've built a sustainable eco-community on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And we tell that story in the book, where they are building their own worker-owned construction company to build this rather than hiring people from outside the reservation. They're building housing, they're building cultural centers, all of this owned by the community. You know, that's one model. In the Bronx, they're the largest worker cooperative in America. It's called Cooperative Home Care Associates. More than 2,000 women who do home care, which is a very exploitative and low-wage industry, have come together to form a very successful business, and their wages are above the industry standard. They're unionized. They have health care and so forth. Many cities now, you asked if it was trending up, many cities across America now have in their city budget money designated to build employee-owned businesses all over the country. So public banking, I mentioned there's one public bank in North Dakota, and a community's control of its capital is absolutely essential to determining the fate of its local democracy. There are now over two dozen states that are developing feasibility studies and legislation to build their own community state bank, as well as individual cities. California has a proposal going through the legislature that's won a tremendous amount of support to establish what is in effect the Public Bank of California, which could be a game changer. So I think the momentum is moving in our direction, and but there's a long way to go, of course. We have a big task ahead of us, to be sure.
Ted, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the book.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, Sonali.
My guest has been Ted Howard, co-founder and president of the Democracy Collaborative. He's formerly the executive director of the National Center for Economic Alternatives. We've been discussing the new book he has co-authored with Marjorie Kelly called The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. It has a foreword by Naomi Klein. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.